And although in quantum physics the effect happens before the cause, normal physics does not allow such thing to happen. So at first we have a cause and then we have effect of the cause. The only way that I could justify a form of expression that you have used is that we were not first dealing with the Big Bang as the beginning of everything, but it was a secondary phenomena that happened after the world and everything was sucked in. Do I understand it properly in terms of causation and direction?
Yeah, almost all of those words I gave you before is a personal philosophy of K2LAW. Have I read that from some authoritative source? Of course not. Dark matter is the easier one to explain. When you look at the rotation of every galaxy, if it was ordinary central force motion, like a satellite going around the Earth, for instance, you put something in low Earth orbit, it's got to move real fast to stay in orbit, because it's close to the center of gravity of the Earth. It experiences a lot of gravitational pull, and it's got to be moving real fast to stay in orbit. You put something in low Earth orbit, and the Earth goes at 17,500 miles an hour. Something in geosynchronous orbit, 22,000 miles up, moves at 6,000 miles an hour. Something in a much higher orbit, like the Moon, moves at 2,800 miles an hour. So you can see that everything further away from a source of mass, from a major central force motion, must move slower if it's in ordinary Keplerian orbit. Therefore, when you look at a galaxy, the galaxy, if it's a spiral galaxy, should be winding up like a spring real fast. The stuff in close should be moving real fast, and the stuff outside the perimeter should be moving real slow. Almost all galaxies do not do that. Let me drop. Almost all of those spiral galaxies move like the spokes of a wagon wheel. It almost keeps the exact same shape. The rate of rotation around the center of the stuff at the perimeter and the stuff in close is almost the same revolutions per century, if you know what I mean. The stuff at the perimeter is moving faster and not slower. The only way you can explain that is if there's a distribution of mass throughout that galaxy that you cannot see. The stars of the galaxy that you see do not have the right distribution to create that almost steady state rotation like a wagon wheel. So there's got to be extra mass, and they call that dark mass, dark matter. But this dark energy, if I understand correctly, is the word given to this phenomenon where you measure the rate at which stuff is slowing down. Do we have an open or a closed universe? And the stuff ain't slowing down, it's speeding up. And the further out it is, the faster it's speeding up. Opposite of common sense. Very hard to believe at first. They call it dark energy. They think there's a repulsive force somewhere. I don't believe that. To make a repulsive force at long range is extremely difficult. I mean, the repulsive forces you and I know about. Let me drop.
Comment.
I can take two, comment recognized. I can take two positively charged objects, and by electrostatic repulsion, they repel each other. So, could I make a positively charged Earth and a positively charged Moon that repel each other? It sounds nice on paper. You try to take something as big as the Earth and make it positively charged. There's a whole lot of free electrons running around in that space, in that free space, outer space, that are going to be attracted to that, and they're going to neutralize it. To try to make something positively charged and keep it that way, very difficult. And for electrostatic repulsion to explain it, you'd have to have a bunch of positively charged planets and galaxies in the center, and positively charged ones in the outer perimeter, and they're all repelling each other, and nobody's neutralizing it. That's a very difficult one to go. And an electrostatic charge is very short range. To have two positively charged things a meter apart, you can measure the repulsive force. You take two positively charged things and move them a mile apart and try to measure the repulsion, I don't think you can do it. It's a very short-range phenomenon. Let me drop.
The space is increasing, Dick.
Yeah, after John, I'm going to ask you for some words on that one. Now, two chunks of magnetism. I can take two ball magnets and put the two north poles toward each other, and they will give repulsion. But you try to do that over a long range, you don't get very much repulsion. And almost all objects, there's no such thing as a unipolar magnet. Everything's bipolar. You put a magnet in free motion on a cork where it's floating, and you try to put the two norths together where you get repulsion, and one of them will flip around. So they almost always go to attraction. So gravity's, so the magnetism's not going to do it. Electrostatic repulsion's not going to do it. I don't know of any other repulsive force other than solar wind. Okay, solar wind and photon are a repulsive force, so to speak. But very, very small force. And at a galactic distance or an intergalactic distance, can you get enough force out of solar wind? I'm doubtful. So we're going to have John and Paul in that order. John, you had a comment on all this. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
KC2WGB. Exactly what Paul said, Dick. That's what I was going to say. We have to look at it as the space is expanding. It has nothing to do with, I don't think, the dark energy. I think it's just space expanding. And that grid, the way it warps around prodigious gravity and the expanding of space, I think that's what's driving the stuff away. Now, what does that? Not sure, but maybe Paul knows.
Well, let's go back to that one, John. If space is expanding, what caused that to happen? Did Big Bang cause that to happen? Over to you, John.
Well, it could be that that's the remnant of the inflation that happened for the first 300,000 years, and that it's lessening now, but we are still in the expansive mode.
Okay, that sounds possible. Let's see what Paul's got. WS2N, K2RIW. Paul, the cosmologist.
I don't think so. I don't think so. This is WS2N. I was going to go with expanding space. To think that the moon and the Earth and the planets and all the stars have some kind of repelling force and pushing against one another at a distance. That's what I'm really going against. No, of course not. I don't see that as being possible. But the space itself is, and in the beginning with inflation, they know that the space is expanding to some degree. With this phenomena, even the space between the atoms would be pushing, expanding, not pushing anything, but just expanding, so that the electrons are going to separate eventually from the photons. Eventually the photons will separate from the cells, the electrons themselves in turn, start separating, and you just wind up with nothing but a bunch of energy. Maybe that's the energy that circles back and eventually becomes another Big Bang. That's the cosmology that I came up with, Dick. I don't know. Back to your WS.
See, that's what they can pick.
Even if space is expanding, and that's something you can look at a multi-galactic size, you get an expansion. But when you go down to really local, at the atomic level, what in the world would make an electron decide to no longer go around his nucleus, Paul? Why would that electron not stay local to that nucleus that he really has fallen in love with? WS2M, K2LIW.
Coming in. Because the space between the proton or the nucleus and the electron is separating. The space is separating. Electron would love to stay right where it is, but since the space is pushing itself apart, that's therefore making the electron, go at a further distance. Not that the electron is going around saying, "Okay, I'm going to force myself away from the photon." The energy is still there, holding it to the to is expanding. Just like the moon and the earth, if you increase the space between, you know, the space itself, the fabric of space expanded, the moon would be, you know, eventually be further away from the earth. I mean, it's that type of thing. So, you know, the gravity would still be there, but then now the gravity would be.
And as you know, the moon is moving out away from us an inch and a half further per year. So far, that's very easily explained by way of the tides, tidal friction. We're going to go to John and Wes in that order, who have just asked for comments. I'll give you the fabric of space expanding as an possible explanation for dark energy. However, the rate at which the fabric is expanding is if you've got this great big sheet of rubber and you're pulling on it, and out of the perimeter of the rubber, you're going to see motion. You look in the center of the rubber across a millimeter material, you're not going to see that expansion. It's taking place, but there's so little of it, so slow. So when you take the rate of expansion of space, and you start looking down at the atomic level, it's my belief that that's so slow at that short a distance that to say that electron's eventually going to leave that nucleus, wow, that's a tough one. KC2WGB, go ahead, John. KQRIW, straighten us out on this one.
Okay, well, this is going to be more confusing because there's a double conundrum here. Now, the cosmologists, most of them say space is expanding, all right? But the size of the galaxies is not getting larger, although they're moving away. So how could it be that space is expanding? The internal space of the galaxies is not, okay? Now, another thing, Paul, if the atomic level expansion is happening, now we have a big problem, because that means our metrics expand with it. There will be zero-sum difference. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, when it comes back to Paul, he's going to have some trouble. He's going to have some trouble explaining that one. If the galaxies are not expanding, but space is, and then you get down to the microscopic or the subatomic level, and we can't see the expansion. There's a conundrum there. In 2XJN, K2LIW, go ahead, Wes.
EC2QIQ with a comment.
And when it gets to him, he's going to straighten it all out. Right now, we've got Wes, Paul, and Glenn in that order. Go ahead, Wes.
Glenn's going to give us the answers.
Yeah, I'm waiting for that one.
K2XJN. Richard Feynman came up when we were talking about the electron with the idea that electron could go backwards in time as possible interpretation of the positron. That was his article in 1949. So he imagined the possibility that perhaps there were only one electron in the world zigzagging back and forth in time. An electron moving backwards in time would carry negative energy, whereas it would, with respect to our ordinary time sense, have positive charge and positive energy. But, it is considered that this is not solved yet, but when you were talking about the Big Bang and eventually the black hole, and I touched the factor of causation, there is an article explaining that in quantum experiment, effect happens before the cause. And that was done to prove that it was a thought experiment, two pairs of particles are either quantum entangled or not. So one person makes the decision as to whether they entangle them or not, and another pair of the people measure the particles to see whether they are entangled or not. And the head scratcher is that the measurement is made before the decision is made, and it is accurate. So that's eventually, if we think about the Big Bang as the beginning of everything, it was interesting for you to mention that it might be a black hole that was just a repeating of the process from the world that was before the Big Bang. And to XGN.
Yeah, I did think that there was a super black hole before the Big Bang. That's world of as that super black hole was being formed, it vacuumed up everything around and created a kind of a void. That Big Bang is starting to fill up again. So from our point of view, the universe of universes is a hollow sphere, so to speak. And so the stuff out of our perimeter is being sucked into the shell of that hollow sphere. So I think the expansion is a gravitational phenomenon. Gravitational being sucked outward. Because repulsive forces over a long range are very difficult to justify, from my point of view. You start getting into the stretching of the fabric of space, and now a little more difficult to picture it. But Paul's going to straighten that out for us. After Paul, we're going to go to Glenn. WS2N, K2RIW.
Dick, real quick, are you saying that our universe is the result of a black hole, so we are the resulting white hole?
Okay. For there to have been a black hole that has all of the stuff in our observable universe, all of those 100 billion galaxies and 100 billion stars per galaxy, 10 of the 22 solar masses, all of that stuff that we're watching that has the Hubble constant of velocity versus distance. So if you really believe in the velocity of Big Bang, all of that was at one spot. That much mass at one spot is way beyond the mass of that black hole. Super, super, super mech black hole, 10 to the 23, 10 to the 22 or 23 solar masses. And if black holes were unlimited in size, everything would be sucked into a black hole and it would all be over. I'm speculating that beyond a certain size, a black hole is unstable. I mean, as you start sinking, as you start stretching, compressing stuff down, you eventually get a white dwarf, you get a neutron star, and the neutron star is where you squeeze the electrons back into the protons, and now you get a bunch of neutrons. Let me drop. You squeeze beyond that, and you have what you have, what we call a black hole. If you squeeze beyond that, maybe you're squeezing the quarks, and you call it a black hole. You squeeze beyond that, maybe you're trying to squeeze the strings. And Mother Nature says, no, I'm not going to let you do that. I'm going to create a Big Bang. So for all of this to work, there was a super black hole, and all that stuff was at one spot, and the black hole beyond a certain size has to be unstable. Otherwise, everything ends. And that super black hole becoming unstable is the Big Bang. That's my crazy philosophy. And so, and now we're refilling that void that was vacuumed up by that super black hole that preceded our Big Bang. And that's a made up on the spot philosophy. WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
Okay, Tim, wow, sounds good. But I'm still going with called the Big Rip. That's my theory. It's the Big Bang. Well, mine is the Big Rip, which I've read about. And that's one of the theories. So in other words, not only do planets and stars, you know, you go further apart from one another at accelerated rates, but so do the atoms. All the electrons start to separate from the protons. The protons from the from the neutrons. The electrons themselves start to separate from you know, electron doesn't become an electron anymore. It just becomes energy. Proton, you know, all the quarks start to separate. The quarks themselves start expanding. And they no longer become quarks. And there's nothing left. And that's what they mean by the Big Rip.
You're drawing a fairly black picture here, Paul, where everything runs down, everything expands into nothingness and becomes pure energy. I'd like to believe that the mass energy product of this observable universe is a constant. You can flip back and forth between energy and mass, but neither one is capable of being destroyed. You can't destroy mass. You convert it to energy. You can't destroy energy. Gets converted back to mass. The mass energy product. I mean, you think that the energy is just going to spread out and go to infinity. Well, something out there is going to collect it back into mass. Is a philosophy. But those guys in Massapequa, they know cosmology. We're about to hear about that. KC2QRQ, straighten this out here, Glenn. K2RIW.
Good evening, Dick. Good evening to everyone on the net tonight. And this discussion reminds me of a physics class I had back in the, I guess it was in the 90s, the electrophysics course. And one of the concepts I'd come up with was the discussion of the universe and all of the inconsistencies. And what my physics professor pretty much alluded to, and let me just let this drop, and this is not an uncommon thing. This is something that in a lot of the higher level physics courses comes up as a very, very common thing. But let me let the repeater reset. But basically he was pointing out was that the universe as we view it, or most things as we dimension it, we usually dimension things in three dimensions, X, Y, and Z. And we have a very, very good handle on those dimensions when we look at something physical. And when we try to apply the same rule into space and we look at X, Y, and Z, here again, it works for most of the models that we have pretty well. The problem is when we add time, the fourth dimension. In other words, it's like, okay, take a reference point with the universe, and it obviously is something moving with respect to time and dimension. So when you try to dimension it with T, you wind up with tremendous inconsistencies. Was it the Big Bang the beginning? Is the Big Bang the end? Is the universe expanding, contracting? And the reason for all these inconsistencies is because we're missing a dimension that we really don't understand yet. And the key thing is when we finally understand what time really is, in other words, and how it's expanding, contracting one way or the other, and properly dimension time, then all these other things should go away, and we'll have all the answers. But right now, we just don't know. KC2QIQ.
A VDH with a comment.
We're going to go to John number two in a minute. Time is not easy to describe, to define. One definition, one simplistic definition I've heard at one time, is that time is a man-made concept that gives order to the sequence of events. It's not something that drips out of a faucet. It's not a physical thing. It's a man-made concept. We have the equivalent of a circadian rhythm. We have a kind of a clock inside of our brain, and we can sort of say that this occurred after that, and it occurred X number of minutes or hours downrange. So time might be a man-made concept. Does it really exist? That's a non-interesting question. But, John, straighten us out on all this. WA2VDH, K2RIW.
Dick, with a follow-up real quick.
Yeah, let me pick up John first, and then you, Glenn. Go ahead, John.
What I wanted to mention was the idea that maybe the strong force has a duality to it. The strong force only operates at nuclear distances, and once you get beyond the distance of nuclear particles, it pretty much peters out. Perhaps this repulsive force is something that operates only at intergalactic distances. And when you start to look at galactic distances of the order of 20, 30,000 light years, then it pretty much peters out. But at the distance of millions or even billions of light years, it becomes very strongly repulsive, sort of as a large-scale duality to the strong nuclear force. It just from the point of view of symmetry, it would just seems to have a nice feel to it. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's a possible explanation that I've heard once before, John, and I'm having trouble with it, because all of the forces you and I know about, with rare exception, all obey an inverse square law. At a greater distance, the force decreases. To suddenly come up with a theoretical force that gets stronger at a greater distance, you try to draw a diagram of how those waves of that force emanate from some central object. Boy, it's tough. So since everything we know seems to follow inverse square law, maybe an inverse cube law, everything decreases with distance. Boy, it's hard to explain. I mean, you can say the words, but how do you construct something that gets stronger at a greater distance? Back to you for a quick one on that one, John. VDH, RIW.
I see your point. It only seems to have a certain satisfaction from the point of view of symmetry, that you see things at extremely small distances that peter out on a large scale, something repulsive at the extremely large scale that peters out the small scale. Yeah, it would require a whole different philosophy of scale of operation of the very nature of something getting stronger with increasing distance. I agree with you there. Back to you there.
It's going to be kind of hard to find evidence of that one to confirm it. I mean, when it comes to string theory, we've gone way beyond the point where you can confirm it with any reasonable experiment we know of now. When it comes to the stuff beyond the observable universe, except for the acceleration of the stuff out there, the so-called dark energy, I think is a hint of it. Except for that, it's very difficult to confirm something beyond all of your instrumentation's ability to measure. And yet you want to confirm it. That's a tough one. KC2QIQ, he's got the answer. K2RIW, go ahead, Glenn.
Well, Dick, here again, just, you know, not to beat on a dead horse, but I think what we're really saying is that when you get to a point to where the measurements that we're making all of a sudden keep on coming up with inconsistencies in every direction, you have to somehow stop and say, wait, hold on, we have something wrong here, this conceptual error. And like my physics teacher pointed out, is that when we look at the universe as a dimension, X, Y, and Z, in three-dimensional space, everything works. But it's when we add time. And the issue is that time is a dimension. It is real. But the problem is, do we have it properly defined? Do we have that dimension figured out? My suggestion or understanding of this is that we really don't. We don't really have a firm concept of time. Yes, it is a dimension. But do we have it properly sized and understand it? No. And I think when we finally figure out what time is and then have that dimension with basically our three-dimensional image of the universe, then all these other questions will all come together, and it'll make sense. But if we use our present understanding of time as we see it here on Earth, like counting with a clock and going forward and backward, some kind of linear time, and try to apply it to our three-dimensional universe, we're just going to keep on coming up with inconsistencies because we're using the wrong model.
I think if somebody else wants to make a comment. Quick question for you, Glenn. How soon will it be before there is a good-sized tower on Division Avenue? Over to you, Glenn.
I'm hoping within a year, Dick. But here again, we might find out the meaning of time before that, but I don't think so.
You have the resources, you have the time to put up the tower. And if anybody would appreciate what it could do, it would be you. Who's the other person who want to make a comment? I just heard one syllable of a word out of you. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's Hank, N1YDY. And I was just going to make a comment that a guy named Eddington, Arthur Stanley Eddington, way back in 1926 or 27, came up with a concept of what he called the arrow of time. And it was at first an attempt to simply explain why, you know, many physics equations look like they'll run both forward and backward. But later in this conversation that he was having, he basically came up with the idea that not only does time only run forward, but the time in and of itself is made up of many other component issues that he said were not quite dimensions in and of themselves, but might be described as dimensions to a lesser mind, whatever a lesser mind is. And one YDY.
Thanks, James Floyd. Boy, am I glad I don't have a lesser mind. That's a joke. Go ahead, Wes.
That was a puzzling subject for many years for the scientists. When I was telling a few words about the cause and effect, that first it has to be something that caused something, and then we have the effect for it. But comparing to what Hank was saying is, there is a backward causation, which is a retro causation, which some people might say is correlated with the time travel, but the science trying to separate themselves from that. It is a common feature of our world that seems to be that in all cases, all the causation, the cause and the effect are placed in the time, so that the cause precedes its effect temporally. So our normal understanding of the causation assumes that the future to such degree that we intuitively have a great difficulty imagining things differently. And the notion of the backwards causation stands for the idea that the temporal order of the cause and effect is mere contingent feature, and that there may be the cases where the cause is causally prior to its effect, but where the temporal order of the cause and effect is reversed with respect to normal causation. So the example that would be that there may be the cases where the effect temporally but not causally precedes its cause. And eventually based on that, somebody would say, hey, well, that would be the time travel, one of the things that we could drive into it. But actually, science disagree and try to separate those two things and see the differences with it, because the time travel involves the causal loops, whereas the backward causation does not. But anyhow, I was trying to put my two cents here and to exist.
When each of us earlier mentioned the entanglement word, that's a troublesome one. I mean, there are certain molecules and objects that supposedly obey entanglement. And when you make a measurement on one, you disturb what happens on the other one, even though the other one might be thousands of miles away. Boy, that's a tough one to confirm that. I mean, you're led to believe what the science shows that we've seen on that subject, that this has already been confirmed. I'm having trouble with that one. What kind of an experiment was used for that confirmation? Is there any possible error in that experiment? Because for me to decide that these two molecules are entangled, I keep one of them in my laboratory. I allow you to ship the other one over to California. I make some kind of a measurement on mine at this instant, and then you're supposed to confirm that the other entangled molecule in California changed its state because I made a measurement on the one in New York. How do you really run that experiment objectively and confirm the timing and that it really took place? It's a tough one there. I'll throw it open to the group. Give me some words if you think you can explain this one. K2RIW, can you explain entanglement in a way that we can accept?
N1YDY, Einstein said, no, you can't. He called it spooky action at a distance. And with that, gentlemen, I'm going to say goodnight. Have a great weekend.
So you're saying, Hank, that Einstein says, I believe it happens, but there's no way to confirm it. Is that almost what you said, Hank?
If I understood Einstein correctly, or if I understood the history that I read correctly, Einstein said he didn't believe it happened.
Now, the good news is that Einstein had an extremely high batting average, but it wasn't perfect. I mean, he was a steady-state universe person at that time. It was a popular way to be. So he had a lot of insight, but it wasn't perfect. So we got to be careful here. K2RIW listening.
Remember that Einstein, again, when you say steady state, he said he believed in a universe made of marble, not one made of wood. You know, he wanted it to be elegant and smooth, and he admitted that it was an emotional need. Okay, I really am clear. N1YDY.
Okay. Have a nice sleep. Hank, go ahead, Wes.
You were talking about entanglement. With the third experiment that I was relating to earlier tonight, the entanglement can be created after the entangled particles have been measured and may no longer exist. said it was one of the postulates. Enter XG.
Okay. Don't think I understood that. John, can you explain that to me?
Made no sense to me at all, Dick. Didn't understand what that meant. So, it's a mystery to me.
Okay. Two pairs of particles are either quantum entangled or not. One person makes the decision as to whether to entangle them or not. And another pair of the people measure the particles to see whether they are entangled or not. The head scratcher, and I'm reading right now, is that the measurement is made before the decision is made. And it is accurate. So it will be the classical correlation that can be decided after they are measured. Then the entanglement can be created after the entangled particles have been measured and no longer exist. And that's the classical example of quantum experiment effect. It's, I believe you can find it in plenty of places. One of them would be Popular Science, but that was, that is not the new stuff. It was postulated in 2001, but the last time I've read about it was in 2012. And to here.
Let me go back to some basics here, Wes. If I've got two particles in front of me, what do I do to those two particles to cause them to be entangled, or vice versa? If I got two particles in front of me that I believe are entangled, what do I do to them to make them unentangled? How do I cause entanglement? Or is it something that exists between two particles, but I can't cause it, or I can't change it? I can only sort of measure that it's there. So can I cause entanglement? Can I stop entanglement? Or is entanglement completely beyond my control? WS, K2LIW.
QIQ with a final comment, I promise.
Yeah, West first and then Glenn, and that order. Good one.
To answer your question, Glenn, pick up.
I just had another thought outside of the present discussion, but just getting back to time, and just as a concept, that our unit for time is based on the seconds. And what? How do we get to the seconds? Well, we look at basically how many times the Earth is revolving around the Sun in a year, and we divide everything down. And from that point, and when you look at that as a time base for studying the universe, you realize pretty quickly that we're dealing with like a crystal that's not calibrated to the rest of the universe. Because obviously when the Big Bang took place, there was no Earth, there was no Sun. In other words, our unit of time, when we try to stretch it using the unit of the seconds as time, is so not calibrated to the universe that it's, it's really, we need a better unit, Dick. KC2QIQ, or a stiffer or a cleaner oscillator.
I've got one, Glenn. That cesium beam oscillator is based on a particular characteristic of cesium. So, same thing with the rubidium. So, as long as the cesium that I have here on planet Earth is the exact same element as that cesium on Alpha Centauri, and it has this this characteristic by which you can build an extremely accurate clock, a clock good to 10 decimal places. So as long as they've got cesium and I've got cesium, I think we got a universal unit of time. Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, but here's even a more fundamental question, Dick. Do you think cesium existed at the Big Bang?
No. I say yes. I see every single element existed. What's left to discuss is how many, what amount of it there. The amount there may have been minuscule, but it's there, is my belief. And by the way, you measure time in seconds. I want to measure it in microfortnights. 1.28 seconds is a microfortnight. Over to you, Glenn.
No, granted, but, you know, it's still based on the second as the unit. And I'm just pointing out that when we look at how we come up with the second and how we basically use that as the rule, in other words, you know, one rotation of the Earth around the sun, and then we try to compare it to other things in the universe that it's, you know, I don't think it's too far of a stretch to realize that many of the errors that when we try to dimension the universe or view the universe from our point of view, that the largest area of error is probably going to be time. And, enough said. K2SW, K2QIQ.
Okay, leap seconds.
Yeah, the leap seconds are because the Earth is slowing down in its rotation. One of the major causes of the factors for the Earth slowing down is that the Earth's rotational kinetic energy is slowly being coupled into the Moon. That's why the Moon is moving out 1.5 inches per year. It takes energy to do that. Where is that energy coming from? Our tidal friction. Where's the tidal friction energy coming from? Earth's rotation. So when the Moon, a zillion years ago, used to be a hell of a lot closer to the Earth, our day was not 24 hours long. I'll bet you our day was 12 hours long during the very early stages of evolution of living material on this planet. K2RIW.
I'd like to answer your question.
Fire away.
Okay. If we assume that that was the 1945 Feynman. If we assume that the radiation from isolated or accelerated charged particles is equally retarded or advanced, that is half retarded and half advanced, to be exact. So we're talking about entanglement. We can explain why it appears to be fully retarded in terms of influence distance absorbers make on our source. And the absorber consists of charged material that reacts with the source field by radiating with half retarded and half advanced waves. In other words, Feynman theory, actually there was Weller and Feynman theory, was taking for granted that outgoing and expanding waves are identical with the retarded radiation, and incoming contracting waves with advanced radiation. Of course, there are certain problems with that idea. I don't know if you see it as an answer, and to explain.
Now, it's not simple. It's not something I can easily wrap my mind around, and I'm not able to walk out of the room whistling that tune right now, Wes. So, it's not super clear to us yet.
I see that we have a few minutes left. If you do not mind, I would like to give a few words about Roy's response and the question that you have had about the particle collisions or eventually the interaction between in the nuclear structure. Remember, you were very much puzzled about the positron collision with the electrons, orbital electrons in MOSFET.
Yeah, Roy's latest email did make positron emission tomography quite a bit more clear. I had some misconceptions as to what's going on there. And so, as I see it, certain nuclear decaying materials give out the positrons, and where that material collects, because that material has made part of a substance that the body wants to collect in certain areas. So when that material is collected in that area, and by way of the scintillation device, you detect in the three-dimensional tomography picture the fact that that part of your body collected that material. It gives you a lot of information about how your body is working, whether or not something is working correct. I think there are coronary diagnostic techniques that are using PET scans that give a lot of valuable information about where calcification might exist within a coronary system, for instance. So I've got a little more understanding by way of Roy's latest email, which he writes some beautiful emails. Over to you, Wes, K2RIW. Question?
Okay.
Somebody said they got a question.
Yeah, once again, could you forward a copy of that email to me? Because I'm as a cancer survivor, I'm very interested in how that works.
Okay. And let's see now.
Do I have your email address, Hank?
Have you mailed emails to me by which I've got your email address, Hank? Or is it listed at PYZ.com?
Yeah, but then when I tried to contact you later at the same email address, it didn't seem to work. Let me just give it to you again. It's easy enough.
By the way, you sent two emails to me. They both arrived. You may have gotten the false alarm that they didn't arrive. They both arrived. Over to you, Hank.
Okay, my, my email is my call sign at Yahoo.
That's an easy one. Okay, I'll send a copy of the, of Roy's latest email to us, to you. And, I think you'll enjoy it. And, a little unhappy to find you're a cancer survivor, but, good luck.
Thanks, and thanks for letting me in, Wes. N1YDY.
Interesting is just to separate two things at once. Particle emitters and energy emitters. Although one might say, well, if we have a particle, we have an energy that is associated with that particle. But when we talk about a collision, we're a physical body, and that physical body has to go somewhere. So usually, it helps if we understand a few lines about radioactive stuff. And, say, positron emission, which actually is later related to positron emission tomography. Yeah, there are sodium-22, carbon-11, or fluorine-18. They go or undergo a nuclear decay, and that is accompanied by the emission of positron. Then the positron then would be the antiparticle to the electron, but actually the size and the weight would be pretty much alike. And this process is similar to a beta decay. Well, when we talk about a beta decay, we're talking about a physical bodies. They have a weight, they have a mass. So when the positron emitting nuclear decays, one of the proton disappears and one additional neutron appears in the nucleus. At the same time, two particles, positron and neutrino, are ejected from the nucleus and escape from the atom at high velocity. So the positron will be that a physical body would be the beta plus. Has the same mass as the negatron, and negatron will be beta minus. And it has a positive charge equal to magnitude to that of the negatron. And the total energy of nuclear decay is shared between positron and neutrino. We know that it's extremely difficult to do anything with the neutrino. However, when somebody is monitoring the energies of the positrons emitted from the large number, say sodium-22 atoms, he finds that the distribution of energy is similar to the distribution of typical to the negatron beta minus emitting nucleates, and this energy distribution is characteristic to all positron emitting nucleus. So it's not only that it's something that is one guy, one specimen, but it's actually something that is very much universal. And now we're going to the positron emission tomography, which Hank would be interested with that. The characteristic of positron emitters in, say, phenomena of positron annihilation. Something is coming out of the nucleus, is going out of the nucleus, is meeting the guy who is being called electron, and say, hey, I don't like you. The electron say, I don't like you, so let's fight. Now, there's two guys have a collision, and they completely destroy themselves, and they make a 511 kiloelectron volt photon, which are emitted precisely in opposite direction, 180 degrees. Now, the interesting fact is, anything you take that possibly can make a collision between positron, which is the antiparticle, to the electron, you always will get 511 kilo volts. That is what Wesley was able to see in MOSFET. So, they emitted precisely in opposite direction. Positron annihilation always gives you 500 kilo-electron-volts, and that is regardless of current nuclei that is being used. Now, we're talking about the particle or the energy distribution. We have a few minutes left, okay, and to XGN. The energy distribution would be kind of random because we also have a neutrinos or anti-neutrinos in many of those processes, and they take approximately half of the energy. But if you try to see them, you would not. You only just to try to see the energy of the collision or energy that's coming out of the particle specimen, and then you see, we're supposed to have 511 kilo-volts, or we're supposed to have something that we see, but we see something that is of very much differentiated energy, so you do the averaging. Now you say, hey, we have that 511 kilo-volts, but we have the energy also that is not necessarily 511 kilo-volts, and that would be sharing energy between neutrinos and the rest of the body. And that is not only because of the 1322, but anything we take. And to XGN,
since the energy of that event is exactly 500 electron volts, 511 kilo electron volts, I'm not sure which it was, are we saying that in a PET scan, the detector is carefully tuned to accept that energy level and no other, so that it knows exactly what it's looking at? Is that approximately what happens, Wes, K2LIW?
The high energy of inhalation photos and the directionality of that emission for the sort of basics of tri-dimensional imaging, which would be positron emission tomography. In other words, you know that you have 180 degrees opposite direction of two powerful gammas, and they will have 511 kilo-electron volts. Now you need to put sodium iodide with thallium, or you need to have a high-purity germanium detector. Now you place them in the opposite direction. And you were using the term which actually, it's a mechanical device that allows you to properly align those detectors. And I just cannot recall that word, that word.
Since the emission of interest is two events that move at 180 degrees apart, I'm getting the impression that to make sure you're looking at the right thing, you use the equivalent of a coincidence detector. In other words, if one of the objects is going to go north, the other object is going to go south. And if I'm looking for 511 kilo electron volts to the north and the south that correspond in time, the same microsecond, on that coincidence detector, now I'm double dot sure of the exact event I'm observing. I wonder if they use a coincidence detector. Over to you, Wes, K2LAW.
WB2SSB with a comment.
They do, but we have a coincidence and anti-coincidence, and both of them could be utilized in it. It depends what you measure. Actually, in Roy, a email he was mentioning Perkin Elmer, and I have probably six or seven Perkin Elmer devices, and at least five of them have a two opposite photomultipliers, and the scintillating material is just a cell where you put the radioactive sample into it. But there was a comment, guy. Go ahead.
Yeah, let's pick up Joe, WB2SSB. And Joe, I wonder if you work in medicine. WB2SSB, K2RIW, and a TechNet. My name is Dick.
Hi, Dick. This is Joe Sanger. I spoke to you a couple months ago about MRI scanning. I'm a nuclear medicine physician, and I work with PET scanners every day. So I can perhaps help out a little bit here.
Yeah, it sounds like you definitely can, Joe. So give us a few words as to what really takes place in a PET scan. I have the impression that the positron-emitting nuclear substance is added to a molecule that the body will absorb, that the body will congregate in certain portions depending on what disease you've got, what condition you've got. And so now, if I can measure the concentrations in three-dimensional space in certain portions of the body, I've got a very valuable diagnostic tool. So the PET scanner is the detection process of the PET scanner, which I think is a scintillation detector. I'm kind of curious as to whether or not it uses the coincidence detection of the fact that each emission has these two separate events at 180 degrees apart. So as you can tell, I'm missing a lot of the details here, Joe. WB2SSB, K2LIW.
WB2SSB. Oh, you've also got a pretty good understanding. Your glass is half full. A positron is emitted from radiopharmaceutical that we've injected into the body. The particular radiopharmaceutical we use is based on the physiology of the disease that we're trying to learn something about. Most of the time, the molecule that we inject is fluorodeoxyglucose. It's basically a sugar molecule in which a fluorine atom is replacing an oxygen atom. So you basically have radioactive sugar that goes into the bloodstream and goes where sugar likes to go. Turns out that tumors tend to take up more sugar than normal tissue. So the concentration of fluorodeoxyglucose in tumors is higher than it is in normal tissue. That's the physiological part. Let me drop. Now, in terms of the physics of detection, the positron is emitted, and it travels around for an average about 2 millimeters until it bumps into a free electron. The body is filled with free electrons, so the distance that the positron moves before it meets its partner electron is on the order of 2 millimeters, at which point, as I think you mentioned before, two gamma rays are emitted at 511 keV. They move in about just about 180 degrees apart from one another. Maybe it's time for you to drop. The geometry of the PET scanner is a circumferential ring of crystals. These anti-parallel gamma rays are traveling out in three-dimensional space in all possible directions. But the concentric rings surrounding the patient, the coincidence of them appearing at two opposite crystals to come up with the line along which that these photons travel. So you get line pairs that all tend to point back towards the source of the original molecules that are emitting the positrons. The process of reconstructing the actual three-dimensional distribution of the radiopharmaceutical is called back projection or iterative reprojection. There's a lot of active work going on in computer science to come up with faster and more accurate determinations of the original distribution of radioactivity, which is what we're after. Let me drop. Any questions?
It's making more and more sense as time goes on, Joe. I can sort of see how, if you have a ring of crystals, which I guess have photomultipliers attached to them, so they are kind of scintillation detectors, there maybe is a coincidence detection procedure going on in that ring to make sure it's the right thing. Maybe that's part of how you detect 511 kilo electron volts. Maybe it's an older machine that I was once exposed to, where a nuclear substance was injected during a...